You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. Also, if you're listening to this as a podcast, it is on Rudolf Steiner Audio, located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures that Rudolf Steiner gave entitled Understanding Healing, Meditative Reflections on Deepening Medicine Through Spiritual Science. 13 lectures and a meeting held in Dornach between January and April 1924. Also included in this is a first newsletter of the medical section, translated by Christian von Arnim. It is Collected Works, Volume 316. And it's also called the Christmas Course to Young Doctors. This is Lecture 1, given in Dornach on the 2nd of January, 1924. My dear friends, the first thing I would like to discuss with you is related to the study of medicine itself. Medical studies today are structured in such a way that they build on a natural scientific view of the world, or rather a natural scientific interpretation, which fails to develop a proper understanding of the human being. And so young physicians see an ill person without being able to develop any real idea about what the healthy human being is like. Because, you see, if you begin by learning about anatomy and physiology, with the idea that the key parts of the human organism are the organs and organ systems, which appear in firm outline, such as the bone structure and the muscular system, and if you have become used to seeing these systems in the fixed outlines in which they are normally drawn, that gives you a quite erroneous view of the human being. For the things which are drawn in this way, and which we imagine as being drawn in this way, what is considered to be the real content of our knowledge, they are engaged in a constant process of development, of generation and degeneration. They are in continuous development, constant coming into being and passing away. And if we now begin to look at this coming into being and passing away, we immediately notice that we have to move away from the fixed outlines in the human organism to something that is fluid and without contours, that we have to imagine the human being as the result of a flow which persists at certain points, and we have to add the fluid human being, if I can put it like that, to that part of the human being which is the least part. We have to add the human being who is no longer subject to the laws to which sharply outlined bodies are subject. The opinion is commonly expressed today, on the basis of anatomical and physiological thinking, that when we drink liquid to satisfy our thirst, and then drink more and more liquid, say a third or fourth glass after the first one, all the liquid we have drunk undergoes the same process in the organism. But that is not true. The first glass of water undergoes a complicated process to satisfy our thirst. But the second glass of water, when our thirst is no longer so great, passes through the organism at a much greater rate than the first one. It does not follow the complicated progression which the first one did, and with the second glass of water, we are dealing to a much greater extent with a kind of simple onward flow in the fluid human being, if I can broadly express it like that. And so we have to say that a true understanding of the human being must, first, take the sharply outlined organs into account, but then also those things which are in flow in the organism. Of course, reference is also made to those things which are in flow, but it is done in a way which only seeks to understand the fluids, indeed the whole fluid configuration of the human organism, in greater detail on the basis of the laws of dynamics and mechanics. It is not the case that the latter apply, as soon as we consider the fluid human being, the so-called human etheric body is involved. The human physical body is merely that aspect which relates to the anatomical drawings, which you can see in the anatomical dictionaries, the books of anatomy. but you will not find the flow of the fluids in the human organism there. The flow of fluids in the human organism is not dependent on earthly forces. Earthly forces are also involved, but it is not dependent in its essence on earthly forces, but on those planetary forces which I spoke about in the lecture. So that we have to say, as long as we are dealing with organs and organ systems with a fixed contour, we are only dealing with the earthly forces. And there's a plate that he refers to. As soon as we are dealing with what circulates, be it the circulation of the nutritional fluids themselves, or the nutritional fluids that have already been transformed into blood, we are dealing with controlling forces that are not earthly, but planetary. We will deal with the matter in greater detail later on, but right now we are looking at the principle. So essentially, we have the solid human being associated with the physical body, the fluid human being associated with the etheric body. Now there is also the aeriform, gaseous aspect to the human organism, and to a greater extent than some people think. Insofar as the gaseous is in our organism as a constitutional vitalizing element, it is dependent on the astral body, so that, for example, human respiration must be understood in its physical manifestation as a function of the astral body. And specifically, with regard to the fourth human being, the warmth human being, I have referred to the physical human being linked with the physical body, the fluid human being linked with the etheric body, the gaseous human being, that is, the activity of all that is gaseous or aeriform, linked with the astral body. There cannot be a moment's doubt that in the physical space occupied by the human being, and even beyond, there are different degrees of warmth. If you take someone's temperature behind the ear, or in the armpit, you will find a very differentiated warmth organism. The degrees of warmth are different everywhere. Just as you can say that the liver is in a specific location in the human being, so you can say that the intestines are in a specific location. Both have quite different temperatures. The liver temperature is quite different, as the liver has a very specific warmth organization. This warmth organization is originally linked with the I capital organization. Only now, really, is it possible for you to picture the human being to the extent that he or she carries the substances which are otherwise present on earth within himself or herself as solid, fluid, gaseous, and warmth-like substances. The warmth element is directed by the I organization capital. But if something is in a particular warmth state, this warmth state has an effect on the thing that is penetrated by the warmth. And this is where we get to the real state of the I organization. The things which the I organization otherwise does in the human organism happen by way of the warmth organization. Let us assume that I am walking. Just walking. In walking, I act on the warmth organization of my organism with my I organization. What the warmth does in the organism, in the same way that the legs contain fluids between the solid parts of the legs, is in indirect consequence of the I organization. But the I organization only acts directly on the warmth organism. We can therefore see the action of the I organization in the whole organism, in the solid, fluid, gaseous, and warmth organization, but only by way of the warmth organization. We can, in turn, see the action of the astral body on the whole organism, but directly the astral body acts only on our aeriform organization, and so on. You can work out the rest for yourself. Now, you see, this opens up quite a different possibility. Take the kind of thing that is provided in physiology and anatomy today, which people outline so nicely and take to be the whole human being. If you take that, you will never have the possibility to get from the human being in this form, who cannot in reality exist, to the soul element, or indeed the spiritual. How in all the world could anything of a soul or spiritual nature have anything to do with a human being as he or she is outlined today in physiology and anatomy? As a result, all kinds of apparently well-considered theories have arisen about the reciprocal relationship between the soul and spirit and the physical. The most ingenious, because the most silly of them, the two things are often connected in our time, is the theory about psychophysical parallelism. It says that both run simultaneously and in parallel, and there is no attempt to seek a bridge between them. But as soon as you rise to organized warmth differentiation and have the intervention of the I organization in such warmth differentiation, you will realize that it is quite feasible that the I organization acts on the warmth ether, and that it acts on the whole human being as far down as the sharply contoured physical organization by way of the warmth organization. The only reason that the bridge between the physical and the soul elements in the human being cannot be found is that people ignore that the human being has this consecutive structure, which in turn is acted on by the soul and spiritual organization. It is indeed the case that if you experience fear, for example, such a simple mental state initially has an effect on your warmth organization. You cannot, of course, conceive that the mental fact of experiencing fear makes your limbs shake. That is inconceivable. And so you have to look for something like psychophysical parallelism. But you can conceive that the soul organization, which is anchored in the warmth ether, is affected by fear, and that such fear comes to expression in a change of your warmth state. In that way, the warmth organization is transferred to the respiration, to the fluid, and as far down as the solid human being. That is the only possibility of building a bridge between the physical and the soul element. Without gaining such insight into the human being, you will never be able to make the transition from the healthy human being, from an understanding of the healthy human being, to insight into the sick human being. Because, you see, if we take some component of the human organization, say the liver or kidney, which under so-called normal circumstances in some way receives its impulses from the I organization, in that these impulses from the I organization first act on the warmth organism and then pass down into the sharply contoured liver or kidney, and so on, if we look at that, then there is, of course, a possibility that this intervention by the I organization through the warmth organization is intensified in the organ compared to the normal behavior. In other words, the I organization has too strong an effect on the warmth organization with regard to the liver or the kidney in a way that it should not. And given the configuration of the human organism, so that the I organization can work properly within it, this also provides the possibility for the human organism to fall ill if these structures appear in a wrong, or if you like, dislocated way. Because if you think of the human organism in the way that physiologists and anatomists think of it today, it cannot fall ill. Where is the illness supposed to come from? There must be some possibility in the organism for the illness to arise. Now, the I organization has, for example, to act on the heart in a certain powerful way. That is, it has to act on the heart by way of the warmth organization. If circumstances then cause what is supposed to act on the heart through the warmth organization to act on the kidney or the liver, In the external world, too, you can divert warmth states to another location in a detrimental and disharmonious way. Then something happens in the organism which must happen there. The only thing is that it has been dislocated, and the possibility of falling ill is given. Only by taking these things into account can you learn to understand how it is possible for us to fall ill, not by any other means. You have to tell yourself that everything which happens in the human organism is a process of nature, but illness is also a process of nature. Where does the healthy process stop and the disease process start? Where is the transition from one to the other? These questions simply cannot be answered if we stop at what we have in anatomy and physiology. Only once you know that what is disease in the liver is healthy in the heart, and is required there if the human being is to be complete, can you learn to understand the possibility of falling ill. Because if the human organism were not able to generate from the eye organization the warmth organization that is required in the heart region, then the human organism would not be able to think or feel anything, for example. But if it acts on the liver or kidney organization, then it becomes necessary to drive it out of there again, to confine it to its original limits, we might say. And you see, there are substances and substantial activities out there in nature which can take on for each organ the activity of the etheric body, the astral body, and the eye organization. Say, for example, that the eye organization acts in an incorrect way on the kidney. This is all by way of introduction today. We will talk about these things in a more technical way in the next 2 days. Let us say the eye organization in the kidney acts too strongly. The kidney is given the opportunity to do what the eye organization would normally do in this abnormal sick state by administering aquisitum arvensa. So you have the situation that when the kidney is sick, the eye organization acts on it in such a way as it should act on the heart and not the kidney. There is activity there which should be somewhere else and which exists because the eye organization intervenes too strongly. You can only remove that activity if you artificially introduce another activity that is equivalent to this activity of the eye organization. That is what you can introduce to the kidney if you succeed in administering the function, the activity of aquisitum arvensa to the kidney in the right way. The kidney has a great affinity with aquisitum arvensa. In an instant, its activity is transferred to the kidney and the eye organization is taken out. And once the sick organ can carry out its diseased activity by different means, and something like the eye organization can return to its original task, then the eye organization has a healing effect. You can call on the so-called higher bodies for a healing action if you drive them out of the sick organ and return them to their task. Then the body concerned will indeed have a healing effect on the sick organ. But if you want to penetrate as far as the forces which exist, if you wish to learn to know the human organization in its relationship to the way that the cosmos is configured, to the way that the three realms of nature are configured which surround the human being on earth, then you have to pursue a science that is different from the science often practiced today. Let me give you an example. You all know what an ant heap is like. You know that you get formic acid from ants. Chemists, or indeed pharmaceutical chemists, talk about formic acid in the way they do, but they are not aware of the following. They do not know, for example, that a forest in which ants do not do their work produces terrible harm through what rots away in the roots, and so on, produces terrible harm with regard to earth development. We might say that the earth perishes from its rotting organic residues. But imagine wood, and I speak here in broad terms by way of introduction, from which the vegetation has been removed. which has gone over into a kind of mineral state, has become pulverized, rotten. The activity of the ants means that there is always formic acid in an exceptionally high potency in the ground and the air in forests. The formic acid penetrates the rotten wood, and as a result, future development is safeguarded, so that the dust does not dissipate into space but can provide material for the further development of the earth. Thus, such substances, which appear to be nothing more than excretions of insects or other animals, actually safeguard the further development of the earth in their function, if their function is properly understood. You see, examining substances in the way that chemists do today never leads to an understanding of the cosmic tasks of the substances. But without understanding the cosmic tasks of the substances, it is impossible to understand the tasks of the substances which are administered internally to human beings. The thing which happens quite unobtrusively with formic acid outside in nature also happens continuously with formic acid within the human organization. As I already emphasized in another lecture, the human organism is dependent on having a certain amount of formic acid within it, as the formic acid restores the human substance, which otherwise falls prey to the aging process. We might note in certain circumstances that a person has too little formic acid in his or her organism. But what you have to know is that the various organs have different quantities of formic acid in them. Now, it is a matter of discovering that a person has too little formic acid in an organ, and then administering formic acid to that organ. You will find cases in which formic acid is administered in which it does not help at all, other cases where it helps a great deal. It can happen that the organism directly resists the administration of formic acid, but that it is quite willing to make formic acid from oxalic acid if the oxalic acid content is raised. In cases where the administration of formic acid does not help, it is often advisable to give oxalic acid, because oxalic acid turns into formic acid in the human organism. That is just an indication of the necessity to be familiar not only with the firmly contoured organs, but also in detail with the fluid process, and not just in the human organism, but also in the cosmos. You see, with regard to certain processes in nature caused by human beings, we can observe them, but their full meaning cannot be understood through a natural scientific interpretation. Let me illustrate a very simple phenomenon. There are fig trees in southern regions. There are fig trees which in the first instance produce wild figs, and fig trees which produce particularly cultivated figs, which are sweet. The people are very sophisticated in the way they produce the sweet figs. They do the following. They cause a certain type of wasp to lay its eggs in the fig, in a normally grown fig. The egg turns into a grub, which pupates. Now this process is interrupted by these people, and in a second run, the young wasp generation is induced to lay eggs. In this way, by a second lot of eggs being laid by the generation which was produced in the same year, a considerable sweetness is produced in the fig, in which the eggs from the second generation were laid. The people in the south do this by taking general figs, which are almost ripe, and tying two together with raffia, so that they hang from the branch. The fig is tapped by the wasps, considerably speeding up the ripening of the fruit, because it has already been cut off. As a result, the first wasp generation also develops very fast, goes over to the other fig, which has not been picked, and it is made significantly sweeter as a result. This process is very important, my dear friends, because in nature itself, in the developing substance of the fig, the same thing is happening in a compressed form, which happens in an extended form when the wasp, or indeed a bee, takes the nectar from the flower, carries it to the nest or hive, and produces honey. The extended process from the flower, whose nectar the bee collects and takes to the hive, to the production of honey in the hive, takes place in the fig itself. The people in southern regions trigger the honey-producing process in the fig by making the young wasp generation tap the fruit. This fig, which has been injected by the young generation, gets a honey-producing process in it. You have here the metamorphosis of two processes of nature, one of which is extended in that the bee takes nectar from distant flowers and produces honey from it in the hive. The other one takes place on the same tree on which the two figs are suspended, which ripen more quickly, where the wasp generation develops more quickly and injects another fig. Because other figs are injected, sweet figs appear everywhere. Such processes should really be studied, because those are the processes of nature which are important. Processes take place in human beings of which physiologists and anatomists today simply have no idea, because they do not extend their observations to such processes of nature as I have just described. It is important to observe particularly the finer processes in nature, because that is the way to achieve a real understanding of the human being. But all of these things require a real feeling for nature, being able to see the connection between warmth, air currents, air warming up and cooling down, the action of the sun's rays on warming or cooling air, moisture in the atmosphere, the wonderful play of the dew in the morning on flowers and plants, the wonderful processes which take place in an oak apple, let us say, which also arises as the result of a wasp sting and the deposit of an egg. You do have to be able to observe these things with a macroscopic eye, EYE. That requires a feeling for nature. And there is most certainly no feeling for nature present if everything is made dependent, as happens in today's observations, on the exclusive focus on the preparation that comes with use of the microscope. You simply remove the whole thing from nature. You see, a terrible illusion exists in this respect. What do we really want to achieve when we use a microscope? We want to see what we cannot see with the naked eye. By magnifying the object, we think it will have the effect it has when it is tiny. But we are looking at a quite false object, an untrue object. Using a microscope only makes sense if you have enough of a feeling for nature for you to be able to modify the object inwardly to its correct small size, after having looked at it in the microscope. Then it is a different matter. You see something quite different. If you see something that has been magnified, you must be able to reduce it in size again within yourself simply through your inwardness. Most people do not do that. People mostly do not have any idea that the magnitudes of natural objects are by no means relative. The theory of relativity is something beautiful and magnificent and beyond dispute for most areas, except the human organism. 3 years ago, I took part in an academic discussion. Those people did not have the faintest idea when they were told that the human organism cannot, for example, be twice the size it is. It would not be able to exist. The size it has is determined by the cosmos in a way that is not relative for it, but absolute. And if it is too large, as in gigantism, or too small, as in dwarfism, we are dealing with medical conditions. And so we have to say that when you see something under the microscope, you are in the first instance looking at a lie, and you must be able to reduce it to the truth. But you can only reduce it to the truth if you have a feeling for nature, for what is happening in nature. Under those circumstances, it is important to be able to look at a beehive and learn that the individual bee is stupid. It has instincts, but it is stupid. But the beehive, as a whole, is exceptionally wise. We recently had quite an interesting discussion up there with the workers, for whom I give a lecture twice a week. We had discussed the realm of the bees, and in that connection a question arose which is very interesting. Beekeepers know its importance very well. If a beekeeper, who is well liked by his bee colony, falls ill or dies, the whole of the colony really does descend into disorder. That is so. Well, one person whose thinking was right in line with current views said, quote, "But bees cannot see that well. They have no idea about the beekeeper. How is some sort of common bond supposed to arise? What's more, let us assume the beekeeper looks after the beehive in one year, and the next year there is a completely different bee colony in it. It is completely new apart from the queen. There are lots of young bees. How is the common bond supposed to arise in that situation?" Close quote. I answered as follows, quote, "Anyone who knows anything about the human organism knows that it replaces all its substances within a specific period. Let us assume someone gets to know another person who goes to America and comes back 10 years later. It will be a completely different person to the one whom he knew 10 years ago. All the substances are different. The assembly is completely different. That is no different to what happens in a beehive, in which the bees have been replaced, but the common bond between the beehive and the beekeeper is maintained. Such a common bond is based on the enormous wisdom which exists in the beehive. It is not just a heap of individual bees, but the beehive really does have a concrete soul of its own." Close quote. That is something which in turn has to be included in our feeling for nature, the view that the beehive has a soul. We will then be able to transfer such views, which are supported by a real feeling for nature, to all kinds of other things. And only such knowledge, which is supported by a feeling for nature, which not only knows how to use a microscope, but also a macroscope, if I may use such a term, will allow us to penetrate as far as the healthy and sick human being. That is what we will do in the next few days, and in doing so we will take account, in particular, of those things which I refer to as morality in medical studies and medical science. That is what we will do in the next few days. The end of Lecture 1 of 13.